My assignment is to talk about what we've been doing with nutrient management as far as trying to address the problems in the Bay watershed, and talk a little bit about why things have worked and maybe haven't worked, and how we need to maybe change the way we think about some of this. I think one of the best things I can say about that we've had in the Chesapeake Bay program has been we've had a lot of cooperation, and recognize my co-authors, Josh McGrath in Maryland, Corrin Ketterings at Cornell, and Roy McGuire. We're sort of the current group. There's been a lot of other people over the years that have been involved in this also. And so we have a very good group in the Mid-Atlantic region as far as working together on trying to come up with solutions to some of these problems. I can shorten this a little bit because you've seen a bunch of these slides already today. So if you don't have an appreciation that we have nutrient problems in the Bay by now, you've probably been sleeping, so maybe just go back to sleep. But we do have problems in the Bay. Tom showed you some of these same slides of the low dissolved oxygen levels and the connection between the nitrogen and phosphorus delivered to the Bay from areas in the watershed that are primarily agricultural. So I don't think there's any question that there are water quality problems related to nutrients, and that these have gotten people's attention. They've been in, these things show up on the front page of many newspapers, and we're not even in Iowa, and you see agriculture in the front page. You usually think about the Des Moines Register, not the Washington Post and things like that. But it has got a lot of people's attention. One of the focusing events was back in, I think it was 98, when we had the Fisteria outbreak in the lower Bay that created a lot of ruckus and focused a lot of attention on water quality problems in the Bay, and that has driven a lot of what has happened since that time. Slide shifted a little bit, sorry about that, but just give you a real quick overview of what we've been doing in the different states. Start with Pennsylvania. We have a nutrient management law that first was passed in 93 and revised last year. In Pennsylvania, concentrated animal operations, and these are operations that are high density, have more than two animal units per acre, have to have an approved nutrient management plan in Pennsylvania. So we have a targeted program. Those nutrient management plans in Pennsylvania were originally based just on nitrogen, but now they're both nitrogen and phosphorus. We use the P-index. Also, one of the big changes in the recent revision to our regulations was a pretty heavy focus on exported manure. What's the ultimate fate of the manure that's moving around from farm to farm? Because these targeted farms, when you hit that two animal unit limit, you're almost always going to have excess nitrogen, so it almost always means there's going to be some manure have to move off the farm. One of the things that we've tried to address, we're putting the regulations on these farmers, but we need to give them some alternatives. We can't just say don't spread it. So there has been a fairly significant initiative in Pennsylvania looking at some alternative manure utilization, energy and various other things that they've been looking at as ways to kind of give farmers some options for what to do. A little bit of report card. In Pennsylvania, we have 2,500 farms that have these approved nutrient management plans. Now, that's only 5% of our farms. That doesn't sound very good, and the Bay model really hammers us on this because it's based on how many acres you have nutrient management plans on. That counts for about 600,000 acres. But I think the key thing is that those 5% of the farms accounts for over half of the manure that's produced in the state. So, by targeting, we are focusing on the farms that most likely to have excesses, most likely to be causing some of the problems we have. So we need to work with the Bay model people a little bit so we can get a little better credit for what we're doing. Maryland, their program, the nutrient management program, was started in 1989. They had legislation, Water Quality Improvement Act, in 98. Again, requires or expects farms to have a nutrient management plan. These are N&P-based plans. Also includes some provisions for reduction of P in manure through feeding programs. It does have provisions for transporting animal manure from fields with excess. We've had a little bit of issue here over the Mason-Dixon line. It's taken on new importance because some of that manure is turned up in Pennsylvania. And so that can be a problem, but I think we've got that worked out. And by 2001, this program, which is largely voluntary through extension and private consultants, has written nutrient management plans for 1.25 million acres in Maryland. Virginia Water Quality Program, again, requires nutrient management plans. You see a theme here. And this is, they're required when they want to participate in certain state programs. In producers that are affected by the Chesapeake Bay Preservation Act, CAFOs, large confined animal operations, have to have nutrient management plans, or farms that need a Virginia pollution abatement permit have to have nutrient management plans. They also had the Virginia Poultry Waste Management Act in 1999 that focused just on the poultry producers, required them to have a pea-based nutrient management plan. One interesting little twist on this one, though, is that exported manure is not regulated, and about 85% of the poultry manure in Virginia is exported off the farm, so it's not really getting at regulating a lot of the manure. New York, New York handles nutrient management through the federal regulations, the CAFO regulations, so it addresses the large confined animal feeding operations that have to have the NPDES permits. To have a permit, like everywhere, you have to have a comprehensive nutrient management plan. You have to meet the 590 standards from NRCS for that nutrient management plan, and so these are NNP-based plans. And the latest I had on that is 100% of the large CAFOs in New York are in compliance, have their nutrient management plan. One theme that's going through all this and is that we've really focused on nutrient management planning as a big part of trying to meet these. Most of this has been using manure to balance the nitrogen needs of the crop. We all realize that because there's a mismatch between nutrient requirements of crops and the nutrient content of manure, when you try to balance these out, you can't balance everything. So if we base our plans on nitrogen, we tend to put on excess P. So that's been an area where we've seen some real problems, just showing Pennsylvania as an example. We can look at the other states and have similar maps and trends like this. But this is just showing in Pennsylvania where the soils that are testing more than 150 parts per million malic 3P are. They coincide exactly with where most of our animal agriculture is. And you can see the graph in the upper right there, the trend. Since back in the 70s, we've had a steady increasing trend in the number of soil tests that are testing in this very high or excessive category. So, you know, it's showing up that we have, we're applying manure, we've been applying manure based on N, we're increasing the buildup of phosphorus in our soils. Ray introduced the concept of the variable source areas and the critical source area management, where we try to look at not just coming out and restricting P, but trying to look at where are those areas on a landscape where it's most likely to be a threat to the environment. This is where we have an overlap of source and transport. If you look at this watershed, this is one of the watersheds that the ARS group in Pennsylvania has worked on for a number of years. In this particular little watershed here, 90% of the phosphorus that comes out of that watershed comes from just 10% of the land area. So the idea behind this critical source area concept is if we can figure out where that 10% is and focus our management efforts there, we theoretically can get 90% of the benefit by only changing management on 10% of the land. So we can use this idea to identify these critical source areas and then to guide management of those critical source areas to improve the water quality. Now, this is one of the areas where we've had a lot of regional collaboration in developing the phosphorus index. Some of you have probably heard of a group called the Mule Barn Group, just a group of us in the region that got together originally in an old mule barn, an Antietam battlefield. That's where the name came from. But we really started to get together to look at what we were doing and developing the P index, and share ideas and commiserate with each other. Frank Cole went through, I think, 63 revisions of his P index in Maryland before he finally got the one that was approved, so we kind of helped him through that. So we did a lot of work in developing the P index. Currently, we've kind of shifted. Most of us have a P index now that we're using. Now it's into how can we get better implementation of the P index and improve it. We've had quite a bit of regional coordination. We have a common P index value scale. We have similar evaluations across state lines. We've done a lot of work on developing the P source coefficients for the direct release of phosphorus from manure on the surface, looking at some of the big picture regional scale issues. This is just one example where we've taken the P indices from four different states and applied them in common physiographic regions. Now, for example, Pennsylvania, we didn't use ours on the eastern shore because ours isn't developed for that. But get up in the Piedmont, we could. And basically all it's showing is that because we've collaborated, pretty much we get the same answer. Our numbers may be different, but in terms of categorization of the risk and the management strategies, we come out with about the same evaluation, whether we're using the Pennsylvania P index or the Maryland P index on either side of the Mason-Dixon line. We've spent a lot of effort in recent years on, as I said, in improving implementation of the P index and just nutrient management plans in general. We've collaborated on education, the P index in developing targeted management strategies, try to work together to develop management tools. An example here is the Cornell Mass Nutrient Balance software that helps farmers determine the balance of nutrients on their farm to help make some strategic decisions about what their nutrient management plan should look like. We worked on financial issues. And the group has been involved, for example, with Doug and the other economists on some of things like the trading and so forth. This thing I mentioned before that we're working on in Pennsylvania is also happening across the region of looking for alternative uses for the excess manure, and we're just really starting to look at this whole thing of manure and energy. One ethanol plant that's proposed in Pennsylvania would bring the equivalent of about a third of our corn production into the state to feed that one plant. I mean, that's got to have an impact on nutrients in the state when you bring a huge amount of corn in like that. We've worked on the whole issue of regional nutrient balance policy. We've had quite a bit of research collaboration. The Mid-Atlantic Water Program Group has put out issue papers, worked on putting on conferences and so forth to try to get some science basis for the policy decisions. And this is for all the stakeholders. It's for the policymakers, but it's also for some of the people that are influencing the policymakers. We have a number of web resources. There's the website Doug mentioned before, I think Tom mentioned also, but just an example of one of the things we're looking at is just what is the regional nutrient balance, and here's just a summary of the trends in phosphorus balance for the states in the Chesapeake Bay watershed in the Mid-Atlantic region, and this is very useful information when you're talking to stakeholders and policymakers to really give them an appreciation for the imbalances or lack of balances, the imbalances we have. I get a little scared. I look at the green line there in Pennsylvania. I like the idea that it's trending down, but if you look at where it currently is, it's very close to 60 million pounds of excess phosphorus a year. So that's a problem. And, you know, we can kind of shuffle manure around all we want, but if we have 60 million pounds of excess coming into the state every year, that's something we've got to recognize, and that's been a tough sell to get the policy people to really get them excited about doing something about that issue. All of this, I think we have made progress. Tom showed this same slide a little while ago, that since 1985, the baseline, we've made steady progress. We're nowhere near meeting our goals, as he showed, but we are making some progress there. But I think we still have to ask ourselves the question, you know, why aren't we making more progress? Why are we continuing to have a problem if we're all doing all these great things? And one of the things that I think we need to recognize is that a lot of the programs we have out there are based on the misconception that farmers are mismanaging nutrients. And that if we want to solve the problem, all we got to do is get them to do it right. That'll clean up the environment. They'll make more money. Everybody wins. But that's really not the case. That's not really why we have the problem. Now, there's some mismanagement. We have room to improve, and we continue to work on better management systems. But the real problem isn't. It's just how our animal agriculture has evolved with very little cost associated with all these excess nutrients. And in general, the economic impact of improving nutrient management is going to be negative. You know, a lot of people still think that farmers are wasting money. If, you know, if they just would see the light and change their ways, they'd make more money. But that's really not the problem. It has to do with how nutrients flow and don't cycle anymore. We have most of our agriculture now is based on specialization, where we grow crops in places like the Midwest, ship them to places like the Chesapeake Bay watershed, where we can feed them to animals. We can do that very efficiently. Those people in the Midwest can do their job very efficiently. So economically, this system is kind of optimized here. We don't really need the land. We can't compete growing crops with people in the Midwest. The problem is when you look at the fate of the nutrients, some of it leaves in what we sell, milk, meat, eggs, but a lot of those nutrients end up in the manure. And part of the problem is that then that's becoming this environmental externality. Because we may be getting corn from 1,000 acres of Illinois corn ground, shipping it to a 100-acre poultry farm in Pennsylvania. So we have the 3/4 of the nutrients from 1,000 acres ending up on 100 acres. And that's really where the problem comes in. And it's not because any of these people in this flow are mismanaging. That's the way the system has evolved. And we can see that some data that Rory put together. You can see the deficit areas here, the light colors, are deficits in phosphorus out here in Illinois and Indiana and so forth. And then you see all the dark areas here on the shore, Lancaster and southeastern Pennsylvania, up in western Virginia, you know, right where the animals are. So we see this imbalance on a national scale. And that's really the root cause of the problems. And it's getting worse because it's driven by economics. You want to make money. That's the way to do it. These are just the trends in animal equivalent units per acre, or animal density on the farms for Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, and they're all basically going up. So we're seeing even greater intensification driven by economics. So, you know, we need to kind of look at, well, why is this happening and why is what we're doing maybe not solving the problem? You know, if we look at traditional view of production ag, farmers are producing outputs, go into the marketplace, we all go to the grocery store, buy these things, that feeds back to the farm production process. Farmers respond to that, they produce the kinds and quantities and qualities of food we want. That's the way it's always worked. There's always been sort of this shadowy environmental output here, though, that we just really didn't pay a whole lot of attention to till recently. But then we get things like the Fisteria hysteria and other things that people start to recognize that this is something maybe we need to worry about. Part of the problem, though, is it's really taken the form of non-market social pressure. So we're all saying, you know, farmers, you've got to take care of this environmental problem you're creating out there. But what I see the problem is we go to these meetings to maybe point the finger at the farmer that you've got to change, and then we stop on the way home, get a dozen eggs and a gallon of milk. And so we're sending both of these signals. We're sending the signal that we want this cheap, high-quality food and lots of it. At the same time, we're sending the signals that you got to do things different. And in essence, what we're really doing instead of solving the problem is just squeezing people. We're putting more pressure on the system. And most of our regulations and policy things come on the social side. They're trying to reinforce these social pressures that we've got to change. And really what we end up doing is just squeezing agriculture a little more. Now, we do try to add some dollars in. Most states have some money going into this. We have a significant amount of money in Pennsylvania that goes into cost sharing, things like that offsets this. But in general, it's not nearly enough, and it's probably not sustainable because it's based on, you know, politics of sustaining this kind of support. And Tom mentioned this figure before. This is that same report on the BMPs that it would take to save the Bay if we fully implemented them, and the price tag they put on it was $630 million. I don't see, and I think you said this, Tom, you know, going to the legislature and saying we need $630 million, probably not going to work. And the other thing that concerns me with this kind of report is that most of these really don't address, other than the feeding one here, really don't address this excess. In essence, most of these BMP-based approaches just sort of build higher walls, you know, around the farms to keep the nutrients from getting to the water. But we still keep bringing these excesses in, and I think that's another thing that we need to recognize. So when we look at the future nutrient cycle, we still got to do a good job of nutrient management. And those of us that work in that area realize that there's a lot of room for improvement, and we're ready to jump in and try to do that. We also need to look at anything we can do to improve production efficiency, you know, feeding programs and so forth, so that more of the nutrients that come into our farms end up leaving in the produce, not in the waste. But I think ultimately we're going to have to get to some kind of nutrient balance. We can't do it all just with nutrient management planning. We're going to have to somehow reconnect this nutrient flow, get those nutrients back where they can be used, where the crops are produced, you know, moving manure, maybe moving animals, some of these alternative uses. I don't know. If I knew the answer to that, I'd probably be on my yacht somewhere instead of standing here, but I'm not that smart, so, you know. But we need to have people trying to figure out how to get this whole system into balance in a way that's economical and sustainable. And really, I think what the ideal is, we got to figure out somehow how to get this environmental cost into the marketplace. So it's not an externality, so that when we go to the grocery store to buy our milk and eggs, we're also buying an environmental benefit. We can solve this problem overnight, we as consumers. We just go to the grocery store and demand that, you know, I only want to buy milk that's made a certain way. We don't need regulations. Farmers will respond. You know, you give them the incentive, they'll respond. So, you know, that's a big part of this whole problem is, you know, we tend to like to work on these technical solutions. Really, it's a social problem of how do we get people to realize that this is a cost and that somehow we got to get it into the marketplace. So I think to really solve the whole Chesapeake Bay nutrient problem, it's not just going to be simply writing better nutrient management plans. It's probably going to require some kind of restructuring in our food system. In the home and the grocery stores, I just said, people are going to have to make some of these choices when they go to the grocery store and change the way they do things. You know, obviously, it's going to take changes on the farm. We've already seen a lot of that. You know, a lot of what we've done so far are changes that, I don't hate to use this, Tom, but you're low-hanging fruit. You know, we've squeezed that out. Now it's going to be more difficult. But again, I think if in the grocery store, in the home, we all make certain decisions, the farmers will change and respond to that, and we'll see a difference. And it's going to take change in government policy. I think one of the things I know the guys that I work with in our state government are sick and tired of hearing me say it, but you know, we've got to get away from just relying on BMPs, and we've got to figure out somehow to get the system into better balance. You know, BMPs are important, but they're not the answer. So anyway, for what it's worth, a little bit of sermonizing at the end, but I feel strongly about this, and we've been working on this in Chesapeake Bay for a long time. Been a lot of fun, but it can be frustrating at times.
Well, that was a terrific